Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Sandy Sawchuk, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today to help you with your pet's health and to answer all of your pet-related questions. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post a photo of your pet and also a question. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, welcome.
It's nice to be here today.
Great to have you back. Now, you had just recently a little tick episode.
I did. I was in the shower last week. And first of all, I'll start with saying I haven't at this point done any travel or camping stuff I like to do. I've been in my backyard in suburban Janesville, which is, you know, your typical small city lot with a few mature trees and so on, but a pretty sunny backyard. And I come to work and that's it. And I had a tick behind my knee. Well, you know, here I am, you know, not the youngest lady, and trying to get this thing off out with my readers on, and it's like, but I did get the whole thing out. Remember, when you're taking ticks off of yourself or with pets, it's best to use either a commercial tick device, which, of course, mine was at work, or if you are using tweezers, you want to grasp right down by the skin where the head is and pull. And you'll probably get a little piece of skin as well with it. So I pulled it out the correct way, and I'm looking at this thing, and it's quite small. And I'm like, well, it doesn't look like any tick I've ever seen before. So I put it in a bag, took it to work, and identified it as a male amblyomma, which is the Lone Star tick.
Yeah.
That is just starting to show up in Wisconsin here. And unfortunately for us, this means that we've got a whole host of new diseases that we have to be paying attention to. I contacted my physician and said, do we do anything after this thing's been feeding? Because I know they carry Rocky Mountain spotted fever. They can carry a virus that's called Heartland virus, which now there's been a couple of people deaths in Missouri from it. Really nothing they can do until I start showing symptoms. So I'm just kind of sitting and watching the time click by and hopefully by
hoping
the time,
for the best.
I know, but you know, so the moral of the story is if you find a tick and you are not an entomologist or a veterinarian that sees ticks all the time, and I even took the tick over to UW Entomology to have a look at it because I wanted to confirm what I thought it was, and they agreed that that's what it was, is to take them into your veterinarian or into, I know that they're very willing to take them on campus here through the, you can go to the entomology's group's website, and they have a whole page on ticks and who to contact there, how to get them sent in so they can evaluate them, and it'd be interesting to start tracking this new tick.
Now, will that affect, say, your dog or your cat if it's
Definitely. And in fact, some of the diseases like Rocky Mountain spotted fever we know can affect dogs. But this is a tick that also carries a disease that we up here in Wisconsin I kind of just close my eyes to it because it's like, well, we don't have that up here. That's a southern disease, but it's called cytokinesis, and it's a disease that's potentially fatal for cats. And so even though cats are relatively resistant for getting ticks, they typically groom them off. We just don't see them on cats like we do in dogs. This particular tick could be a real problem for them. The other ticks that carry things like Lyme disease and anaplasma, like the deer tick, the cats seem to be really resistant to it, and we just don't see clinical cases of it in cats. Mm. So they're just a different species than dogs. But because of this new disease, I'm pushing people that have indoor outdoor cats to make sure they use good flea and tick control.
There we go. Well, Maureen and Ripon has a question for you, so let's go to her next. Maureen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'm really on my alert now. I just was using Natural Defense on my two dogs. It's just a spray because my one Golden has some tremors, and I thought that the frontline Certifec might be affecting him. Mm-hmm. So I just went with this Natural Defense. Well, of course, we've had already 3 or 4 ticks on our dogs.
Yeah, the herbal products just don't work very well.
No.
And when you said Frontline CertiFact, that's actually two different products.
Right. We first tried the Frontline, and then that was not working well. Then we went to the CertiFact, but you know what? They weren't working that great either.
Yeah.
I mean, they did drop off, died, and did that was probably, but some did stick and, you know, got engorged. Now my vet wants to go with NexGard, it's called.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's a new drug, or oral medication, and I'm just wondering what your thought is on this and side effects with my dog with the tremors.
Oh, well, NexGard is an oral, the first and only oral tick control agent, but it also controls fleas as well. The chemical name is afloxolaner. It's in a beef chewable cube. So, you know, my concern is that this is not a chemical that is going to be on the exterior of the pet. And so that does take the flea or the tick to bite to be able to get enough of this chemical to be effective. So if you're in a really heavy tick area, that may be a problem. You're going to be seeing more ticks. They're eventually going to die, but you probably will be seeing more of them. So as a product, I am not using it in my practice at the veterinary school. I think we could order it in for someone who wanted it. It is a little pricey. You're going to find that it's probably, I'm just guessing off the top of my head, but the 50% to 100% more than the topicals that you can get through your veterinarian. But I think if you're in a low risk tick area, your dog doesn't have any issues with flea allergy dermatitis, where it takes a flea to bite them to trigger it, it would be a very appropriate product to use. But, you know, even with my own pets, this would be something. I did have some samples sent to me, and I did a little taste test with my dogs, and they ate it down wonderfully. But now that I found a tick on myself right in my own backyard, I'm switching gears and going to be using spot-on products for my pets. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. May I ask spot-on products what you mean by that?
Any of the topical ones. I mean, there's a kind of two approaches that we can use. Either the spot-on things like Frontline. CertiFact, I believe, is being pulled off of the market. The ingredient that worked a little bit better against ticks, that was found to cause an immune skin problem in rare cases, but it still was considered to be of some concern, a condition called pemphigus foliaceus. So they are pulling that one off the market, and they now have another Frontline out that is called the Frontline Tri-Tac. They've included a permethrin in there to give a little bit better knockdown effect on ticks. So I think, you know, those would be, I would either stay with the straight old Frontline Plus, or I would go with the Tri-Tac if you can get it. It's not available in Wisconsin yet. That's one of the problems.
Oh, there we go.
It's amazing, yeah, for the area, we're in Ripon. We are infested with ticks, honest to goodness. It's just horrible in the high grass.
And the other thing that you may want to look into is there's a collar that the Bayer Company came out with called the Seresto collar, and it comes in a tin. They run about $40 or so at our clinic, I think $44 for the large dog size. They last for about 8 months, and they lose some of their efficacy if the dogs are in the water a lot, but down to about 5 months. But that would be something that I've got lots of positive feedback from people around the state saying that that's a very effective tool for controlling ticks.
Oh, wonderful. There you go, Maureen. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. So that's one that you recommend.
And they have it for cats and dogs. And I just have not done it yet, but I'm planning on putting them on my cats, who like to sneak out the dog door once in a while and sit on the patio. But hey, who knows where that tick came from? So
yeah.
I'm going to be putting collars on both my cats.
And now again, what's it called?
Seresto collar.
Seresto collar.
By the Bayer Company. Yep.
The aspirin people.
Yes.
There we go. Judy and Racine. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I just have a question. If metronidazole has any problems taken long term?
Yeah, metronidazole is also known as the brand name Flagyl, and we use it for a number of things. Some in humans, a lot, it is used for treating parasites like Giardia. We will sometimes use it as, it doesn't work very well for Giardia. We will sometimes use it with other drugs that work a little bit better against Giardia. We'll sometimes use metronidazole in dogs that have like colitis and so on. You have to be careful with dosing it. And I think that long-term use, I've had a couple of patients that had kind of chronic colitis symptoms, and one of them was referred and came in with profound neurologic signs that just being hospitalized and taken off their metronidazole for 3 days ended up recovering. So it can affect the brain, even with at appropriate doses. But many of the published doses, even in veterinary like pharmacy books and so on, are way too high, and we can see issues with neurologic toxicity with it. So it kind of depends on your dog, and it depends on the dose you're using. But I think there's better things to use long term if your dog is having some issues with its bowels.
Mm-hmm.
His problem is it hurt him to poop. I mean, to the point where the kids wouldn't walk him because it was so embarrassing. He really screamed when he had to poop.
Mm-hmm.
And this has taken away that problem. But I was hoping either we could taper down or, you know, that it wasn't going to be a forever thing.
Yeah, though this may be something, I mean, when you have a dog with chronic colitis, we worry about things like something simple like whipworms. So, and they're kind of hard to find on a stool check. So, you know, asking your veterinarian to just therapeutically deworm your dog for that, or consider using long-term treatment like Sentinel, which is a heartworm preventative that will get whipworms on a monthly basis. You may also want to be looking at having a colonoscopy done and seeing what's going on in there. Do we have inflammatory changes? Is there a stricture? Is there something else that could be causing some trouble? And actually getting an answer rather than just throwing medication at the dog. What metronidazole does is it does have some anti-inflammatory effects. It works on protozoa, like Giardia, to some degree, not very effective. And it also helps control some of the anaerobic bacteria that may live in that area as well. So if they've got a problem with bacterial overgrowth or something, that could potentially be an issue too. So I think, yeah, you'd have to get a diagnosis, and that means a little bit of the gastrointestinal extravaganza workup.
No. Veterinarians seem to be fascinated with pets' feces, don't they?
They, you know, we see people coming in with, you know, their little baggies and containers, and you can just tell from the look or on their face and the way they hold it what it is. But we just very willingly take the stool back and do our thing with it. But the main reason why your vet asks you to bring in a stool sample at least once a year, preferably twice a year, to evaluate for intestinal parasites. I think people have the misconception that you can see parasites that are living in the dog or cat. And there are some that you may find, like tapeworms, that are visible without having to go through any of the special steps to evaluate the stool. But what we're actually looking for is either the organisms themselves, like Coccidia, Giardia, which are little microscopic organisms, or the eggs of the reproducing parasites living in the gut. We know that just in general, about 35% or so of the dog population in the United States has at least one parasite living in their gut. And some of these can be very bad for people to be exposed to. And so if you've got a dog that's defecating in your yard, we just had one in recently where we did a stool check and the dog had hookworms in its fecal material. And the problem with that is that when the dog is defecating and those eggs are in the environment, they love warm, humid, moist weather, kind of like what we've had for the last few days. And those little larvae will crawl up on grass blades. And guess what? They don't mind attaching to people. And you can get a condition called cutaneous larval migraines. And so they get little like red tracks under your skin that are quite itchy for an extended period of time. So I ended up having to not only treat the dog, but instruct the owner to keep their children out of the backyard or bearskin if they are out there, wearing shoes to avoid contact. Even like open-toed sandals could potentially be a problem in the yard until we've had a good frost which means next fall. So, yeah, so their backyard's kind of off limits for a while. Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. You can join in if you have a question for Sandy. Maybe you have a photo of your pet. We'd love to see it. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your photo there and ask your question as well. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. All our phone lines are filled right now, but the number is 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Steve and Stevens Point next. Steve, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, I'm calling about my cat, or my wife's cat, actually. She's about 8 or 9 years old, and recently in the last month, she has started peeing outside the litter box, usually in the bathroom on one of the floor mats. And I've been keeping the floor mat in there just because I figured that's where she's been peeing. I'd rather keep it there instead of throw it out and maybe she'll pee somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife made me get rid of the mat last night, and the cat did pee in the living room.
Okay. First thing you always want to do is make sure that your cat is healthy, and that means taking this cat to the veterinarian and having a urine sample evaluated. And because of her age being like on the cusp of seniorhood here, we would probably recommend doing a little bit of blood work as well, because there are some medical problems, kidney disease, diabetes, hyperthyroidism, that can affect the cat's the amount of urine that they make. Sometimes it's something directly involved with the bladder that could be a problem. And so the cat may start associating the litter box equals pain, and I don't want to use it. So that would be your first step. And while you're there, your veterinarian probably sit down, or the technician sit down and ask you a series of questions about the management of your litter, you know, litter situation in the house. And I'll just kind of run down kind of my, if someone says, okay, in 30 seconds, what is the, you know, best litter box arrangements you can make for cats? And here goes. We want to have a litter box for every cat plus one. So if you have one cat, you need two litter boxes in two separate locations in your home, preferably on separate floors, not near any major appliances like furnaces, water softeners, and so on. Uncovered boxes, soft, scoopable, sandy litter that you scoop daily, if not twice a day. None of those electronic boxes or anything like that. You know, making sure that the cat has easy access to it, that they're not going to feel trapped, that it's not in a dead-end room, and that it's not near any of where their food is as well, because just like us, we don't like to eat in the bathroom, and neither do cats. So those are just kind of some of the basics that we would use. We don't like to use liners. If it's kind of questionable, so it doesn't really bother a lot of cats. But I think the mistake people make is they see these covered boxes in the pet store and they think that that would be best. And guess what? What you can't see, you don't clean. And they're often very crowded for cats to be able to move around in. The litter box needs to be big enough, too. 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to butt. So, you know, if you've got a big cat, a little female, probably not a big issue. But some of these big males like Maine Coons and so on, we need to be really creative and come up with non-commercially available litter boxes like storage bins where we've cut out an opening and left the lid off, cement mixing trays, those types of things that are really big and easy to take care of. So I don't know if you're breaking any of those litter box rules, but those would be things that we'd want to fix as well.
I have to say, and you, as you well know, Sandy, one of our cats, Coco, started going outside the litter box, and it turned out to be a significant health issue.
He almost died because he obstructed, not once, but twice, and is now sporting a slightly different anatomy because of the fact that his urethra was quite scarred down. So, yeah, and the urine that they may be passing, you know, people say, well, there's no blood in the urine. Well, you can't tell unless you actually are spinning it down and looking under the microscope to see what's going on in there. Sometimes you're lucky enough that it will be discolored, but in many cases the urine may look perfectly normal and yet does show evidence of disease.
Mm-hmm. So certainly a trip to your veterinarian is in order.
Number one, yes.
Thank you, Steve. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Dave and Slinger. David, thank you for calling. Hi.
Sure, hi. We're getting a new puppy in the fall, and haven't had one for quite a long time. We have two children, 8 and 12. And my question has to do with training. I believe that dogs should be well trained so that they are fun to be around and other people aren't bothered by them. And in the past, I would have them sleep on a pad by my bed and work with them, stay calm, that sort of thing. But this new thing now is cage training, and I was told to have a cage and keep it in our bedroom. Is that the best way to go?
Well, crate training is not much different than what you're doing. What it will provide, in fact, I can tell you tonight I'm getting a new puppy, and I have not had one for 34 years. And so that's why I'm glad I'm doing the show today, because tomorrow I'm probably going to be yawning through the whole thing. But I think, you know, people look at a crate as a place for punishment, but it can be a very convenient spot where the puppy can be in a safe spot where they're not going to wander off and chew on electrical cords or get into trouble. If you kind of follow the rules with the crate and not crate abuse them, meaning leaving them in there for too long, they tend to not want to go to the bathroom where they sleep. So you have to have a crate that's obviously sized appropriately for the size of dog that you've got. If it's way too big, they can sleep in one end and, you know, eliminate on the other. And so it's not going to work that well. But it tends to inhibit them from wanting to go, so that you increase the odds of when you take the dog outside, they have a full bladder and bowels and are able to go to the bathroom and get positive reinforcement from you. So so the crate is kind of a place that they can go to. I have had a dog crate set up in my bedroom pretty much forever, because my adult dogs like to just go in there and lay down and chew on a bone. They feel very contented in there. So, it's never, you don't want to use it for punishment. And I like crates. And I think that unless you're an extremely light sleeper, it's going to be very difficult to ensure that puppy's going to be staying on that sleep pad all night long without getting into trouble. And if you have a normal family that has to leave and do things and be gone for an hour here and there, which is important for even the development of the puppy to learn that life goes on without humans around, a crate will be a very effective tool to maintain the dog in. Again, you can leave them with some safe toys and a blanket if they're not just really destructive. You come home and you've got a happy puppy that had a rest, and you don't have to worry about the rest of your house.
What do you think about the puppy training classes that are out there?
Oh, I think they're wonderful. You know, when there was a number of years ago, they did a study at the shelters, did a study at why dogs come back by a year of age. And one of the big predictive factors was that the owners did not take the dog to training class. And so they tried to homeschool it themselves, or they just didn't recognize the importance of it. And I think the training classes do two things. One, you've got someone there that is kind of independently going to be watching you and your dog and help train you as to how to train your dog. It's going to give your dog the opportunity to interact with dogs of different shapes and sizes as well in a controlled environment. It's a very good write-up at the American Veterinary Society for Animal Behavior. They have a mission statement on their belief on how important early training is. And they feel that, and I totally agree, that after the dog has been vet checked and had at least one set of vaccinations, not completely immunized, taking them to a class that has washable floors with puppies all in the same boat is you know, going to be better for the puppy than waiting until they're past that really critical stage of development when they're done with all their vaccines. So, you know, I think it's going to depend on the training class that you want to attend, where it's held. I wouldn't be taking a dog to an outdoor training class. I like to get them started ASAP, 8, 9, 10 weeks of age. Make sure it's a class that uses positive reinforcement, food treats, and so on. I think that's really important. And so go visit. You've got some time before fall to go visit some classes and find one that works for you.
Yep. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, David. Appreciate your call. And I want to go to a email question, I believe, from Christy, who says, we have a golden retriever puppy we plan to neuter. Studies have suggested that neutering goldens early will lower the chances of cancer, which is common in goldens. Other studies suggest it's better for their joints, bones, if you neuter after 1 year of age, after growth plates have closed. At what age do you recommend neutering for this breed?
I am kind of a rogue when it comes to neutering. In the United States, most veterinarians, and I'm probably going to get some hate mail from my colleagues out there, I mean, they advocate, let's get these dogs, you know, spayed and neutered before they reach puberty. And I think in some situations that would be very appropriate if you've got an owner that's going to be unreliable, not allow their dog to get pregnant because she's come into heat and they're not being watched. But I think the benefits for large breed dogs, in particular golden retrievers, because that's one of the studies that they've done. They did it out of UC Davis. Really shows that the orthopedic disease problem, hip dysplasia and knee issues and so on, are going to occur much less frequently if you spay them after a year of age. You may increase the risk in female dogs, spay or neuter, I should say, of developing breast cancer, but it's very minimal if they just have one or two heat cycles. But I had this article, and I haven't had a chance to proof it yet and come up with some talking points, but I've got some things highlighted. This study, the study indicated that sterilization not only significantly impacted when companion animals might die, but also provides novel information pertaining why individuals die. And so they found that that life expectancy for neutered males and females, meaning that, you know, even if they're neutered after a year of age, increased by up to 26.8%. So they spayed and neutered animals are going to live longer compared to sexually intact animals. But sterilized dogs were significantly more likely to experience fatality associated with select tumors and immune-mediated processes. So, you know, you have to weigh out everything. And I think, you know, getting them spayed or neutered shortly after a year of age is going to give you the orthopedic benefit, but you'll also then have the benefit of having a dog that's going to live longer. We still have lots and lots to think about with this.
Ron in Marshfield has a question for you. Hi, Ron. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry, and your good doctor. I have a little rat terrier, about 10 pounds, and very hairy. I bought this new product. It's called BioSpot Defense from Smart Shield. And I'm wondering if the doctor knows anything about
that. I don't. What is it used for?
Fleas and ticks and flea eggs.
Okay. Do you know what the active active ingredient is? Because there are hundreds of flea and tick products out there, and I tend to not memorize the brand names, but I like to know what the active ingredient is.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Very small print, and they got something right over it.
Okay, yeah.
So I
does it say on the does it say on the package, do not use on cats anywhere? They usually have it in...
No, it's for dogs only.
Okay, well, if it says dogs only on it, and hopefully it says somewhere on there, do not use in cats, it's probably, most of the over-the-counter products are what are called permethrin-based products. And permethrins are a synthetic version of a natural product called pyrethrums, which are not very strong and effective, and it increases the efficacy of them. But you have to be really careful that you're dosing effectively. When they did, the EPA did a study looking at reaction rates to these over-the-counter products, they were the ones that were the most commonly implicated, the ones that had a permethrin-type drug in them. And there are several different types of permethrins out there. And they also found that if you used one that covered a wide weight range, like me, you know, like 2 to 25 pounds or something like that, that there was a higher rate of toxicity. And their recommendation was that they need to come out with more product sizes to meet the needs, especially of small dogs. So, you know, again, without knowing what the active ingredient is, I'm really hard pressed to say, one, how safe it is and how effective it's going to be. That is why your veterinarian is your best person to go to say, what is the thing I should use on my dog? They're the ones that are up to date on you know, everything that's out there. And I have to admit, even though it's sold over the counter and not by prescription, people have that perception of, if it's prescription, it must be there must be a problem with it. It can't be as safe as something I can just buy over the counter. And that's totally false. So, yeah,
there you go.
Be careful.
Be careful. And thank you for calling. And you can join in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Louise in Dodgeville, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who has a bunch of barn kittens, and we're going to adopt one. And I was just wondering, how soon is too soon to take a kitten away from its mom, or how early can you
adopt
them?
Well, some of that's going to depend on how they're being raised in the barn that they're in right now, the farm that they're on. If they get a lot of really good human contact, gentle handling, starting from about 2 weeks of age and up, you're going to have a kitty that's going to be very social, like being held, enjoy being around people. And, you know, that's because the cat socialization time is much shorter and ends earlier than it does in dogs. And so, so if the cat's been, you know, is being handled and doing well, I'd say, you know, letting it stay there until they're 8 weeks of age or so, just so it gets the benefit of being with mom, learning how to play appropriately, and, you know, proper social skills. But you're also being very dependent on the people that are there to make sure that they're doing everything right as well. So the downside of taking a kitten too early is it may become very bonded to you, but they don't learn proper play technique. They tend to be more aggressive because they don't have anybody giving them the proper correction, just because we're humans and not cats. And so a lot of, like, the bottle-raised kittens and so on just tend to not be normal with behavior. So I like to have them stay with mom for, you know, as long as possible, but then you're also fighting that battle of different diseases and so on that may be out there, and we want to start getting them checked and immunized. So 8 weeks, I think, would be a good age if you could.
There you go.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And, you know, having one kitty, I think there are kittens out there or cats out there that like to be alone. But mm-hmm. then there are, I'm thinking of our two, that really like to have, that they're happy that they have each other.
Yeah. And, you know, there were studies done looking at where, you know, the inherited factors for this. And they actually linked it back to how social the dad was. But good luck trying to locate dad and find out who he was, because most of those are just, you know, they've come by and off to the next farm. And, you know, so there is genetics behind it, but it's also how they're raised early on. And I would guess that I know one of your cats in particular was, you know, on a farm where it was, you know, lots of handling
right.
all very early on. And that's what it takes. It really takes that.
Yeah. Gary in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, how are you today?
Great, appreciate your call.
Yeah, I have a question. I guess I'll get right to it. I don't want to take up too much of your time. Frontline versus revolution, okay? Our vet told us, and we're cat people, right? Serious cat people. I'm just a cat fanatic.
Okay.
Anyway, we have two. They're brother and sister, and our vet told us to use revolution because the revolution will take care of internal things like heartworms and internal things that that cats can get versus Frontline. But the problem I'm having with it is Revolution takes care of fleas and everything. It does everything but ticks.
You got it. Yeah.
Now, my question to you, Doc, is you put the Revolution on monthly, just like you do Frontline. Would it be possible to put Revolution on our kids, I call them our kids, 1 month, and then switch to the Frontline the next month, and then alter that month every other month?
I'd have to say no to that, because what Revolution is a totally different product than Frontline. Revolution has a chemical in it called selamectin. We use it in dogs and cats. You're right, it's labeled for flea control, intestinal parasite control, roundworms and hookworms, ear mites, and scabies to some degree as well, which is another external parasite that they get. We also use it for heartworm, okay, and cats that are being outside, even though heartworm disease is fairly uncommon in this area in cats, when cats do get it, there's no treatment for it like there is in dogs, and it can be fatal. So I think if you've got an indoor-outdoor cat, you do need to have them on some type of monthly heartworm preventative as well as intestinal parasite treatment. And whether you use Revolution or there's another one that's very closely related called Advantage Multi that's made by the Bayer Company, either of those are going to pretty well cover exactly the same parasite load. But the one that they don't cover is ticks. And so I think one of the things that you may want to look into is if you're using Revolution to maybe consider putting one of those Seresto collars on that I mentioned earlier in the show that lasts for 8 months. That's going to control fleas and ticks. That's going to be on them. It would be compatible with Revolution and wouldn't be a problem. So I'd rather than using, you know, multiple spot-ons. But if you are going to be using spot-on flea and tick treatment, you'd want to be using like the Revolution or Advantage Multi once a month, and then that once a month, but maybe separated by a couple of weeks. And, you know, I guess it gets to be a pain in the butt. So why not just use the collar?
What's the name of that collar again?
Seresto,
S-E-R-E-S-T-O. Oh, S-T-O?
Yeah, so S as in Sam, E-R.
S-E-R-E-S-T-O.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's made by Bayer?
Bayer, like the Bayer Aspirin Company.
Yes.
Yeah.
And where are these available, please?
You can get them through online pharmacies. Your veterinarian may have them. You know, they are available online, but also...
You can't.
I don't know if you could get them at a pet store. It would probably have to be through an online pharmacy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Seresto, it's a flea and tick collar is what you call it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good luck.
There you go. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. And again, thank you for joining us today. Sean in Wausau has a question. So let's go to Sean. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a two-part question here. We're moving, and our two cats have been getting along. They never got along well. They've been just hating each other more and more as time goes on. And we're an opportunity. We can give one cat away to my father-in-law, and she's a real nice cat. I think she'll get along alone. And we just wanted to, you know, any special considerations you have in the situation. And the other part of it is my father-in-law is considering getting an automatic scooping box, and I heard your guest say that she doesn't recommend those. I want to know why.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad that you were able to find a cat-free home for your cat to go in, because that's not fun for them to have to live always, especially if, you know, you've got a cat that's being bullied all the time. It can make life pretty miserable and also lead to a lot of behavior problems. So I think that's wonderful that your father-in-law is going to be taking this cat. The reason why we don't recommend electronic litter boxes is that for many cats, it's scary. Okay, so when they're getting out of it, especially, but this is probably more in multi-cat households. One cat gets out, the other one walks in, and it's going through its sweep mode to clean it. They may avoid the box and go, well, the carpet's just as absorbent. Let me use that. Most of the electronic ones, remember what I said, the litter box needs to be 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to butt. And if we, if you measure the litter holding capacity of these things, they're usually too small because they size them like a regular litter box, but then a third of the space is taken up through, with the holding bin for the waste and the tines and so on and all the electronic parts. There are some litter boxes out there. There's one that's, I think it's called the Litter Robot, that looks like almost like a front-loading washing machine with a hole in the front, and it rotates. And again, for many cats, all it takes is seeing this thing going off once, and they may avoid it. I think that if you're going to be adopting a cat, that is, just one of the things is daily scooping the litter box. It doesn't take much time, especially if you're using the scoopable litter. You're just getting the waste out, and it's just part of being a committed cat owner using something like that. If it sounds too easy, it's probably going to be a problem. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
So much.
All right. Thanks, Sean. Bindi in Menominee Falls, hello to you.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a small dog, half Chihuahua, half wiener dog, and both his back patellas are shot.
Okay.
One was tripping over a string, the other one was jumping off and got his foot caught in a blanket. And the surgery is very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there was a place, a college that, does surgery on dogs?
No. I mean, even the teaching hospital here in Wisconsin, which is open to the public, in our charter, we are required to charge at or above what local practitioners charge. We are not in the position to be able to compete against other veterinarians in the state. There really aren't any schools that I know of that offer surgical work like this. I'm just questioning the diagnosis. You said patella or kneecap. Does your dog have luxating or slipping kneecaps? Is that what's going on? Okay.
Yes, all of a sudden he's walking bow-legged, and he'll stretch his back leg out like a little fairy.
Oh, boy. Yeah, yeah. Depending on how severe the problem is, the surgery that's done to repair these can be as simple as, just putting a big pleat down the side. It's called a lateral imbrication. Sometimes these dogs, you need to widen the groove that the kneecap sits in. And so that takes, another part of the surgery. And then in other dogs that have had chronically luxated knees, they have to actually remove a piece of the bone from the lower limb where the patella, I don't know if it's a tendon or ligament, attaches. Sorry, there's an anatomically correct, I don't know which one, but and actually shift that over. So it can be very involved surgery. And, I always like to tell people that you kind of get what you pay for. If you find something that is, inexpensive, is it being done by someone that is going to be cutting corners? Are they actually, doing all the, doing everything correctly, using the right implants and so on, if something needs to be done? And it's also one of the reasons why, which is too late for you right now, I strongly recommend people getting pet insurance. It's not that expensive. Only a small percentage, less than 5% of the pets in the United States have pet insurance. But you know, I already have it on my puppy that I'm adopting, and I don't even own him yet. So just because even though I'm a veterinarian, I'm not a surgeon. And if anything came up, I would be in the same boat you are in and, wondering how am I going to pay for this. So, I wish I could help you, but I can't.
I was I was just wondering if there was a facility that I could have taken him or could take him to. I just hate to see him suffering.
I would contact your local shelter. There are sometimes, you know, veterinarians that will do, you know, pro bono work for the practice on shelter animals. I'm not sure if they would do it on an owned animal, but it would be, that would be a good place to start.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. And boy, we have lots of great photos up on my Facebook page. Let's see. There's Kyle's got one of Buddy, an Australian cattle dog, Sharpei mix, 10 years old, hoping for a few more years out of him. And then there's Julie. And look at the smile on on those dogs.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, a Jack Russell Terrier. Buddy has retired, but
still a working border collie.
Yeah. So there we go. A couple of great photos you might want to look at on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's go to Joanne and Holcomb next. Joanne, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, let me take you off speakerphone. Hi, I'm calling about a follow-up with those with the ticks you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have found a total of 4 ticks on my 2 dogs that are tan and soft-bodied, and they seem really big to me, but they're an insect.
Yeah, they're probably fully engorged ticks. Ticks are actually pretty tough critters, but once they feed, then their abdomen gets quite enlarged and soft. And so my thought is that they've been on long enough that they have fed and have a belly full of blood.
This was after they had been treated with Frontline Plus.
You know, and this is the issue that we have is that within our state, we are just have such a heavy tick burden. There is no product that is 100% effective out there. And so it's really important that if your dogs are going out in taller grasses and areas where, or even in my backyard, that you do daily tick checks and remove them early on before they have a chance to feed. The other thing that I recommend is that if you've had a dog that's been bit by a tick, talk to your veterinarian about testing for the known tick-borne diseases. There are many out there that we don't even have tests for, that we know that, we keep coming up with new tick-borne diseases all the time, but there's some easy blood tests that can be done to just see if there's anything you need to be on the watch for.
Yeah, and we have done that. These ticks did not look like the average wood tick.
Yeah, take them in take them into your veterinarian if you have them, and they should be able to identify them for you.
Okay, because my concern was that they were that when I looked on the internet, this tick looked a lot more like the one from Texas you had recently seen.
Yeah. And even those they're very unique. The Lone Star tick has a spot on its back. And they can be, you know, lighter or darker depending on, you know, their size and so on, but there isn't really a unique color. It's more the ornamentation, the length of the mouth parts and so on that we use for identifying what they are.
Mm-hmm. There you
go. I see. Okay. Well, that's very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Joanne, for calling. Bonnie in Fort Atkinson, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, I don't know, why is it that the vets seem to recommend Frontline when I prefer Canine Advantix because that takes care of, it repels mosquitoes as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've always lived on the water.
Yeah, I think one of the big reasons is that many households have more than one species of pets, dogs and cats. And Advantix is a very effective product. I've used it in the past and you like it, but it has one of the active ingredients is a permethrin product that is in there that's what repels the mosquitoes and it helps with ticks as well. And that is not safe for use on cats, or when I'm using it in a household where cats are commingling with dogs, I'll tell people to keep them separated for a day so that the cat can't cuddle up to the dog while there's still a wet spot on them, or sleep in an area where the dog slept where some of the active ingredient may have come off. After, 12, 24 hours, you're usually fine to let them mingle. And that's why I've gone ahead and used it myself on my own pets. But that's, that's maybe one of the reasons why. The other reason is that, for veterinarians, this is available over the counter. You can get it at farm supply stores and pet stores and so on. And, having something that may be unique that can, come from the vet clinic and that is something that makes you come back to your veterinarian. I know it may come down to business type sense. Wow. Frontline also, when you buy it over the counter, you lose that guarantee. If you buy it from your veterinarian, they will pay if you get a tick or a flea outbreak, not ticks, but if you get fleas in your home or on your pet, they will pay for an exterminator to come to your home, regardless of whether you were even using the medication correctly. They don't question it. But if you got it from your veterinarian, you do have that guarantee, and you're not going to get that if you get Frontline, at one of the big box stores.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice little perk.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
Okay.
Okay.
It's
thanks.
Canine Vantix,
though. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Ray and Rhinelander. You have a quick question for us.
Yes. My question is, okay, I don't care what the cost is now. We're all so sick of these deer ticks, I'm telling you. I will pay whatever it is. Okay, now, let's use you and your dog for an example. What products would you use, and what are they for flea collars and applications?
For ticks, okay.
Well, I tell you what, this is a really difficult question to answer, and sometimes it's whoever I've gotten a sample from. And yeah. I use it because my dogs are often the test animals. But it really is going to depend on the lifestyle of the pet, children in the household, and other pets in the household. I can't make that decision by just saying what I use is good for everybody, because there's lots of other things that we need to consider.
You have cats, birds,
yep,
and everything else.
I do. So I have a menagerie that I have to be concerned about.
Yeah. All right. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. You can join in with your questions. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. She'll be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mehler with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She is taking your questions about your pet's health at 1-800-642-1234. If you're near email, you can send us a message at talk@WPR.org, or you can leave a comment on the Larry Mehler Show Facebook page. And Sandy, once again, thanks for being with us.
Oh, today. You're quite welcome.
Lots of good questions here coming up. I'm thinking as I look at the call list, and Ellen in La Crosse is next. Ellen, thank you.
Hi, I'm calling about my new foster border collie cross who doesn't want to eat, has spent a long time in a kennel environment, kind of boarded, and now is with me. And I guess my bottom line question is, do they eventually come around and eat, or should I try different foods? Or
he's just not eating anything?
She begs for table food.
Okay.
She has learned that.
Okay.
And she eats small little bits. Now, they told me she should have a cup morning and evening, and she isn't eating anywhere near that.
Okay, okay.
And she's drinking water,
mm-hmm.
And she does, she's still voiding, and she's had some liquid stools early when she came here. She was really kind of nervous and anxious.
Okay.
And that seems to have normalized, but I haven't seen her eating more than just a couple little bites of her kibble.
And I, you know, without actually witnessing her, you know, we don't know if it's just the environment that is she's frightened to eat, whether there is something medically wrong with her. Hopefully, before she was, you know, given to you for fostering, she was had a thorough physical exam done to make sure that she's healthy and normal and doesn't have a reason for becoming anorectic. You know, making sure that her teeth are normal, that, you know, guts feel normal, all those things. I mean, she needs a head-to-toe good physical exam and probably a little bit of blood work, too. And then, you know, it's a matter of you know, maybe trying different feeding dishes, like a plate versus a bowl. You know, maybe hand feeding if she's not that shy that she'll take it from you. That could be possible. Maybe trying different temperatures of food. You know, it can be tough, but one of the things that I've had, you know, pretty good success with is there are on the market these sausage type meals that you can get for dogs that, at our, one of our local pet stores, they're all hanging on a rack. They come in different sizes. They're made by the company. One of the companies that makes them, is Natural Balance, and they're extremely palatable, and they have to just eat like a, you know, it varies on the size of the log that you buy, but like an inch or two per meal. And it's, they're complete and balanced, and it might be something that you could try because people, we use that a lot for training treats. It's really palatable, but it's also something that would be a full meal if she were to start eating something like that. So give that a try and see if it doesn't make her perk up a little bit.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Ellen, for calling. James in Fountain City. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about heartworm medicine. My dog has been on it his whole life. He's a 7.5-year-old yellow Labrador.
Mm-hmm.
And I've recently read about the use of generic heartworm medicine, which is a little cheaper, and also about the frequency of application. It was suggested that it's not necessary to give it to them once a month, that the active ingredient actually will kill the heartworm or the heartworm worm. Even after it's started to form in the animal, that if it gets past a certain point.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is understanding the life cycle of heartworm. And people really don't have a good handle without understanding the whole life cycle thing. So when the mosquito bites the dog that is, you know, the mosquito that's transmitting heartworm, they are giving to the dog some immature larvae that very quickly go through a couple of molts and then kind of gradually work their way from the skin to, towards the heart. And the monthly heartworm preventatives, the day you give it, is eliminating the larvae that are in the dog's system from what it was exposed to the month previous. And actually, it's probably pretty effective for about 45 days. When you start getting past that 45 days, those larvae have matured to a stage that is harder to get and is it doesn't always kill them. And so, although, you know, you may see in the literature, you know, heartworm preventatives being used for even treating active heartworm disease, it's not 100% effective. You probably are going to be building up some resistance in the worm population. In fact, the American Heartworm Society has, you know, recommended that veterinarians not use the monthly heartworm preventatives as a way of treating heartworm disease because of that particular problem, the resistance developing. So could you get by with treating your dog every 45 days? Yeah, but the problem is remembering. First of one month, 15th of the next, then skip a month, and then it's the first of the next one. It's very confusing to do that. And remember, the other part of heartworm prevention is also the intestinal parasite control. And their life cycle, the intestinal parasites, are much shorter. And so if you were to stretch it longer, you've now given your dog that opportunity to develop clinical signs and start shedding eggs in the environment, which can affect not only other dogs, but you as well. So I would still stick with the month and just use it once a month and not try to stretch it anyway at all.
Hmm. Well, the generic versions of, I guess it's Frontline, I'm not sure which one I'm using, But those, I mean, the active ingredient is the same ingredient.
So. Right, right. So Frontline is actually a flea and tick preventative, not a heartworm preventative. The same company that makes Frontline makes HeartGuard, and there are some generic ivermectin heartworm products available. There's IverHeart Max, there's TriHeart Plus, and they are just made by different companies. They're not going to be in that meaty cube, but there is really nothing different about it except for the fact that, you know, it's still ivermectin and it may just be in a slightly different base that you're getting into your dog. So you can go with those generics, but, you know, just know that you still need to use it monthly.
Good luck, James. Thank you very much for calling. And Kathy in Marshfield, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a black lab, and I found two deer ticks on her the other day, and I called the vet to see if I could get some dicloxacillin, because I know in humans, you know, you have a deer tick, you call your doctor, you get one pill of dicloxacillin, and you're set, as long as it's within 36 hours of seeing and removing the tick. Now, my vet said, well, they don't do that in dogs.
We don't. And the reason...
Well, why is that?
And it's doxycycline, I think, is the name of the drug that you're mentioning. The main reason is that the majority of dogs that get exposed to ticks do not develop clinical signs of disease. It's actually fairly... And Lyme disease in people is a whole different... ball game than it is in dogs. And so although we do see rarely some, you know, pretty serious complications in dogs, a condition called Lyme nephritis, it's unlike people that get the neurologic form and you know, where it's a much worse disease. And it's just because we're different species. So, you know, typically when we find a tick, and because dogs are the sentinels for ticks, because they're right down at that level, they've got their head down in the grass, they're sniffing. And remember, ticks don't jump out of trees or fly through the air. They're holding on with their back legs to little branches and grass blades and so on that are probably no higher than about 18 inches off the ground. And they've got their little front legs out doing something called questing, where they're just waving around. And as soon as something brushes against them, they hold on and go for a ride. And typically it's your dog, because they're going to be down at that level compared to us. So we see lots and lots of ticks in dogs, but do we see lots and lots of tick diseases? Not as much as in people.
So then why do I get her a Lyme vaccine every year?
Because when they do get Lyme disease, which is still uncommon, Lyme vaccine is about 90% effective. It's not 100% effective, but it all comes down to a numbers thing. We may get one tick and be really sick. Dogs may get lots more than that, and it just happens to be that one special one that transmits the disease. And so I think it is something that we can prevent. We don't have a human Lyme vaccine. There isn't anything like that available for us to use. If there was, I think many more people would be taking it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for calling, Kathy. And let's go to another Kathy in Lancaster this time. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm calling about my cat, Megan. She'll be 18 years old this fall, so she's been around for a while. And she has arthritis in her back hips, and it's causing her problems. She's... it's been getting worse over the last few years, and I'm wondering if there's anything that I can give her to alleviate some of that discomfort. Now, currently, I use a massaging wand, you know, with the heat and the vibration on her back hips. She loves it.
Good.
And it helps. But she still has those issues where she really tight in the morning, and she kind of walks sideways sometimes when she first gets up. And I'm just wondering if there's something that I can give her.
This is a real problem for veterinarians in treating cats for pain. In dogs, we would go to the class of drugs called a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, and dogs can handle them chronically, and we do this, you know, frequently. We'll have them on carprofen or Prevacox, or there's a whole host of them out there on a daily basis. Obviously, we have to monitor them. The problem with cats is that they don't metabolize them as well. They have a lot more toxicity issues, and you have to be really careful with dosing. And so although we use that class of drug, and there's a couple of them that have now been labeled for cat use, we have to be careful that we only use them for a very brief period of time. It's not something you can use chronically. And plus, her being an older cat, she may have some other underlying diseases like kidney disease or liver disease that those drugs could have detrimental effect on. There's a sublingual drop that you can use that's called buprenorphine. The problem with that is it can make cats a little wiggy, and they just are not, most owners don't like the side effect, but if you need good pain control, like postoperatively or so on, that is an excellent drug to consider using. But again, long-term use, probably nothing that you would want to jump into. You may want to look at some of the joint supplements that are out there, like the glucosamine chondroitin sulfate. Is it going to help? Maybe. Is it going to hurt? No. They make cozaquin for cats. This would be something that your veterinarian may be able to have a brand that they recommend. Since you have started doing some physical therapy, that is something else that you may want to continue doing, but maybe working with an actual animal physical therapist and getting some other things that you can do that may provide longer-term benefit than the massage wand. And also be looking into acupuncture. I think that that is an undervalued veterinary resource, and there are more and more veterinarians that are getting certified in acupuncture, and it really helps some of these patients too. And it's amazing how calm they are when you're putting these little needles in them. I just am always amazed when I see a patient that, comes in and then just is like, oh, that feels good. So, look into that. Talk to your veterinarian, see if they can refer you to someone if they're not already doing it themselves.
Well, she has had laser therapy, and that really did help.
Good.
It gets a little costly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, some of the things, may... like acupuncture or physical therapy, where it may be exercises and things that you can do at home that's going to help maintain those strengths. So it may be an initial investment, but it's going to provide you with things that you can do at home that may be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And Pete in Saratoga, Florida?
Yes. Hello from Saratoga. Hope you guys are all doing well.
We are. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you. Sort of an oppy question, but again, back on the tick area arena. I look back in the woods in a swampy area with the trout stream in back and some fishing ponds. I also have honeybees. My Gordons in the past, including my current girl, Zoe, all of us get tick loads that are just insane. I had to go to the hospital one time just to get a shotgun antibiotic treatment, IV deal, just to get rid of it. I use anti-tick stuff on her, and it just never seems to work. My question is, possibly, do you know of any way of treating my area that won't hurt the bees, won't hurt the wildlife, such or that way, with, say, like a fogger or something that could reduce this?
No, I mean, I would have to talk, probably working with an entomologist to see if there's anything that you can safely use, but ticks are pretty hardy.
Heard of it.
No, and I would be really afraid of the environmental impact trying to get one species and with not affecting anything else. The one thing that you may want to look into, and again, this has been being looked at for dealing with deer ticks, are these things called tick tubes that are like cardboard tubes filled with permethrin laced bedding that the white-footed mouse would then take back to their den, and so it kills the ticks on them and their offspring in the den. And so that's like just addressing kind of one of the vectors for deer ticks. You may have a whole host of other species of ticks that you're dealing with in the South that we don't even have up here. I think, you're just doing tick surveillance, changing the environment, opening it up so there's less grasses and things, but you're going to totally change the look of where you're living, and it sounds like a pretty marvelous place.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
it sort of scares me that way, of doing anything that way. I want things for the bees. I want to keep this tick load down. This is central Wisconsin, but it's just insane. It's to the point that, guys at work and ladies at work, they will have a tick on them and just freak out and everything, and it's like, hey,
Yeah.
My pole has
yeah. Yeah. I know. It's, you know, people look at ticks as scary things. I look at them as very interesting and always trying to learn more about them. So, yeah, they're not that gross.
And I think Phil said once, if you lived in a sandbox.
Yeah, then you may not have ticks.
Then you probably wouldn't have ticks.
But if it's moist enough sand and out of the sun, that can support flea development. So you have to be careful and make sure the sandbox is covered, because if you've got feral cats or stray cats wandering around, good chance that you're going to have roundworm and hookworm eggs in there. And then you're going to get, you know, all those issues of coming in contact with sand. And
you're a real spoil sport.
I am. Yeah. I look at the woods now and I don't see the beauty. I see the bugs, and it's hard, you know, to look at it that way.
Well, Don in West Salem has a question. Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I have a 13-year-old black lab, and in the last year and a half, she's developed this habit of digging and eating dirt. I talked to the vet I use here, and he just started laughing and said he never heard of that before.
Well, you know, I always worry when I see a dog that is actually ingesting dirt. I've seen several cases of dogs with gastrointestinal diseases that have gotten and developed some weird picas or abnormal eating habits. So rather than laughing, I would probably be saying, let's have a look at your dog and figure out if there's any liver problems, pancreatic problems, anything that could be a problem. So getting some good blood work screening, I think, would be in order. How far you go after that with, you know, working up an intestinal problem would really depend on what we find on physical exam and maybe some, you know, basic lab work. But, you know, if she's actually eating the dirt and not just getting it in her teeth because she's, you know, going after burrowing rodents or anything, boy, you know, it's weird for an older dog to suddenly develop a behavior like this. If she'd been doing it all her life, I would say, yeah, it's habit, most likely not a big problem. But 13 years old and just recently starting to do this, I'd start thinking of some medical problem.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call as well. You know what? We've heard a lot today, and I think vaccines have come up more than once. And I know you've had questions from people. Why can't I just buy the
vaccines over the counter? Yeah, because you can go to your farm stores and so on and find vaccines. There's a number of reasons. This actually just came up in my exam room the other day. I had a puppy came in that a breeder had done their own vaccinations on, and the vaccine that they picked had ingredients in it that are generally not recommended. And so you're looking at this vial and you're going, a vaccine is a vaccine. Let me just pop this into the dog. This particular vaccine had hepatitis in it, which is, I don't know of a veterinarian that uses a vaccine with hepatitis. That's called adenovirus 1. We use vaccine that contains adenovirus 2, and that protects for hepatitis. But this particular vaccine just had hepatitis in it, and it can cause serious eye inflammation in dogs. And it's like, we've known this for years. It should be taken off the market, but it's still on the market. They also included leptospirosis, which had, you know, lepto is a bacteria that there's multiple forms that dogs can get exposed to. And this one contained only 2 of the 4 forms that we need to vaccinate against. And yet, you know, so it was a very ineffective vaccine. Plus, they gave this vaccine with leptospirosis in it to a 6-week-old puppy, not at the time that you need to do that. That should not be given until they're 12 weeks of age or up. So the downside is you're not going to know, you're not going to have your medicine background to know what is the appropriate vaccine to give to a dog at a certain age. People may not know exactly how to give it safely. Has it been mixed correctly? Has it been stored correctly? Maybe on your end it has, but I could guess that, you know, when a farm store has a load of stuff coming in, that vaccine may not be taken in and refrigerated properly at the right temperature, you know, if you've got a load of lumber or something that needs to come in as well. And if your dog has a reaction, what are you going to do? Unless you've got a bottle of epinephrine and a critical care unit in your kitchen, you're going to be in big trouble. So have vaccines done by your veterinarian.
We have a serious question from Jackie, who wants to know, what kind of puppy are you getting?
Well, it's a no-brainer. I'm getting another English Bulldog puppy. I think that it's a breed that, you know, they have lots of health issues. I am absolutely enamored, and I love the breed. They suit my lifestyle. being a veterinarian, I can care for them. And I still got pet insurance, though, because, you know, even veterinarians still sometimes need that. And his name's going to be Pete, a little Petey. And, yeah, we're going to be getting him tonight. So, yeah.
Oh, so a sleepless night I had?
I imagine. I imagine.
Well, we'll look forward to next month and get a report on Petey.
I'll send you some pictures, okay?
That sounds great. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. She'll be back in a month, and we'll hear all about that new puppy. I'm sure of that. And she'll answer your questions as well. Tomorrow at this time, we'll explore our streams and oceans. At 11, we'll take a look at Wisconsin's trout streams. And after 11:45, there's a new graphic novel introducing us to 12 endangered species in our oceans. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.